Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of the Dissident Film Club. My name is Keaton Weiss, here with Justin Van Voris.
Hello, hello.
And we are here today on Thursday, August 20th. This should be up by probably Friday, the day after the last day of the Democratic National Convention. And so we thought it appropriate to discuss what in many ways really is, I mean, a revolutionary film by a revolutionary filmmaker, a very radical filmmaker named Haskell Wexler. The film is called Medium Cool, and we are going to talk about that. Justin, you have some special sort of connections to this film. Not only did one of your film school professors do the audio commentary to the DVD, so you have some insights there, but you were also fortunate enough to actually interview Haskell Wexler, who is a legendary cinematographer, directed a few films himself, but he's mostly known as a DP. You were able to interview him pretty shortly before he died. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. No, he died in 2015, late 2015, and I interviewed him at the end of 2010. But so back now, we're going on nearly 10 years ago now. When I was at college, in Hunter College, I took a class that you... Basically, you watch one movie in the entire class, the entire semester, I should say, focused only on that one movie, breaking it down, dissecting it, and then you got to write some sort of paper on it at the end. And so this particular class, I forget what it was called, that was the movie. What we're discussing today, Medium Cool, was the movie. And my professor, who I'm just going to refer to now as Paul, for the rest of the podcast, Paul Cronin, directed a 4-hour, he's going to have to correct me, I believe it's a 4-hour film on the making of Medium Cool, and he knew, obviously, Haskell Wexler personally, and he wrote a lot about it. A few years later, he wrote a book about Werner Herzog, which he had me read, and I'm actually in the special thanks of the Werner Herzog book, A Guide to the Perplexed, which is an excellent book if you like the work of Werner Herzog. But we focus solely on this particular film, and I was able to actually interview Haskell Wexler for the paper that I ended up writing for that particular class.
The film is about, it's interesting. I mean, the movie takes place against the backdrop of the Democratic National Convention in 1968, the one that was very famously disrupted by riots in the streets of Chicago. And the movie is really one of the first examples of cinema verite in the United States, right? I mean, that was a French movement, this sort of movement to bring more realism to cinema. And not only did this style of filmmaking change the way movies were made to a certain extent, but it also really expanded the parameters of what we would see on screen in movies. Because before this movement, you really had a very sort of polished and packaged view of human life portrayed in cinema, right? You didn't see much in the way of vulgar language or sexuality or violence or anything like that. It was a sort of more, like I said, a polished version of reality. And even the films that were made in the subsequent years and decades after this cinema verite movement, which, like I said, began in France and then came to the U.S. in the form of movies like this right around this same time, even the movies that didn't adopt that style were still able to take advantage of what this kind of filmmaking brought with it, which is a sort of expansion of the kinds of things that we were suddenly allowed to see on screen.
Yeah, it's, this movie was very influenced by the works of Jean-Luc Godard. That time, the late 1960s, was kind of the birth of the new Hollywood movement. You had movies like Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde, which were... At that time, some of the more realistic types of films. There was a kind of a kind of a new mandate within a lot of these newer filmmakers at that time. That, for example, if you know if you're filming a scene at a bar and you know you put money down, you know there's got to be a shot of it. There's got to be a shot of like the exact change, like you would see it down to the smallest detail to get the realism correct. And those films ended up being obviously, as you mentioned, there's more sexual situations. There's more language, and there's a lot more violence. Medium Cool does, it blends, if you haven't seen it, blends fiction and nonfiction into one thing, where it was probably one of the first films of its kind to actually film fictional scenes within non-fictional environments. Because what they did was, and this is something that, you know, filmmakers like me like to do for production value. You just go where the action is and you film your shit around it. And so at the end,
because what you're saying is you don't need a budget to recreate, say, a Frank Zappa concert, right? There's a sequence in this movie that takes place at a Frank Zappa show. And that was a real Frank Zappa show that they just happened to film at.
Yeah, well, that wasn't it. I mean, that was just it. The whole Democratic Convention.
Well, yeah, the riots and right.
And the when they're train at the very beginning, they're training. They had so. I mean, just to give you some more historical context, 1968 was an extremely volatile year. Martin Luther King had been killed. Bobby Kennedy had been killed, and it was they were Richard Daley, who was. Real authoritarian character, who was the mayor of Chicago, convinced Lyndon Johnson Lyndon Johnson, I don't think, had announced that he wasn't going to seek re-election at that time. But anyways, he convinced them to hold the Democratic National Convention in Chicago that year, and to show off his work, how good a job he was doing in the city. But Chicago, there were a lot of riots in Chicago, and they kind of knew, the filmmakers, Haskell Wexler, knew that all this pent-up anger over the war in Vietnam and a lot of other things, knew that something was going to happen at this convention. And it did, because there were riots. And so Paul Cronin likes to talk about how, has mentioned that... when the movie came out, they felt that the filmmakers were almost prophetic, and like, oh, wow, they knew that this was going to happen. They had a feeling it would, but there was no guarantee that any of the stuff that you actually see in the movie was actually going to happen. But they kind of had a feeling that it would. So at the beginning of the movie, you have these the soldiers and the riot police. They are training to deal with rioters that they would expect at the Democratic National Convention. And then the whole movie is like that. They get these different scenarios. There's people talking from the cameras that are not scripted. And then the whole big piece of the movie is the end during the Democratic National Convention, where, yeah, they just had the lead actress, Verna Bloom, just walking. She's supposedly looking for her son. She's just wandering through these real life riots, which you probably couldn't get away with today. Like you probably SAG probably.
Yeah, no, there would be not. Something. I mean, the closest example that I can think of, a recent example that did something like this, was Terrence Malick made a movie that took place at, I believe it was the South by Southwest Music Festival, in Austin.
Yeah, I didn't
see that. There's a film I believe, I don't know if that was one with Christian Bale in it.
Yeah.
I forget the name of it, but he filmed real scenes at a real music festival that was actually going on, right? So that would be, I think, the most recent example of something like this having been done.
Yeah, like they were able to get in to the Democratic National Convention. Because if you notice, if you watch the film, it's Robert Forster's character. He doesn't say anything in those scenes where they're actually in the Democratic National Convention. And it's just him and who's ever filming it, the cameraman. And so what they did was, I believe it was, Haskell Wexler knew Warren Beatty, and Warren Beatty had two tickets to the National Democratic Convention. So he gave them the tickets. And so they just kind of went in with like their news camera type things, obviously. So they just kind of assumed that they were press, but they're actually guests of Warren Beatty. And that's how they got the footage of inside the Democratic National Convention. Which I don't know about you, but I love those scenes. Interesting kind of parallel between what's going on. And there's this one sequence where I think they're playing Happy Days Are Here Again. And there's like the juxtaposition between what's going on in the convention, what's going on outside the convention. If you don't know the story of the movie essentially has no story, at least until like 1 hour into the movie. But it's where it's basically about a cameraman and who for the first hour of the movie is just
sort of dispassionately chronicling what he sees. He films car accidents and gives them, you know, to his news network. And he's sort of covering the events at arm's length, right? Doesn't really feel particularly involved or invested in what's going on.
Right. Sorry, yeah.
Is it okay that I
take
over?
Absolutely.
No, yes. But you're right. Then 1 hour into the movie, I mean, it's a very odd movie in so many ways, but 1 hour into it, he finds out that his network is actually giving footage to the FBI.
Yeah, that's when the story begins, really.
Right, that's the inciting incident. Takes place more than halfway into the movie, because the movie is 1 hour and 50 minutes long, 5-0, mm-hmm. So 110-minute runtime. And yeah, I mean, it takes more than halfway through before there's really any plot taking shape at all. But anyway, go ahead.
It's basically just these scenes of this reporter kind of witnessing these different events. And it's kind of like the first hour kind of like washes over in you a way where you just are let into kind of this world that they're creating, where you're it's a slice of life, really. At which point then you're kind of thrust into the main focus of the story, which is the Democratic National Convention, which the movie has been kind of building towards, but not in any story kind of way, but in terms of the setting, specifically. It touches on a lot of stuff that we talk about today, like race relations, poverty. He befriends this boy named Harold, who in real life was from Appalachia, Harold Blankenship, who was from West Virginia. And there's a scene, I don't even remember what they go to when he's visited by a social worker. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
So a lot of those answers are scripted. I think some of them are not scripted, that he's answering as himself, as Harold Blankenship, who played the young boy. I mean, it's not for everybody. Its lack of plot can I think probably turn a lot of people off. But it's just a great document of that time. Because we were able to, through it, get really close up to that, like I said, very volatile time in history. Did you catch, like, during when they gas them towards the end of the movie, you hear someone yell, "Look out, Haskell, it's real."
I didn't pick up on that.
Which is weird. It's, that was something that Haskell Wexler had heard. But it wasn't like recorded, and he actually re-recorded that line.
Oh, really?
in post, which is weird. But there are different. There's a lot of instances of that where they break the fourth wall, so to speak.
Sure, yeah.
Where there's that one scene where he's complaining to his boss, and his boss won't give him film, and there's this very kind of awkward shot where he goes, "They have film," and he points at the camera. He's actually kind of pointing at the supposed filmmakers who are making that actual film.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie that is a lot easier to respect and admire than it is to actually like and to actually enjoy. I mean, it's not a very dramatically compelling movie. I almost think that just a straight-up doc would have done the trick just fine. Although there is this extra factor here of, you know, telling a fictional story within real life environments. And so, you know, it's a movie that looking back, I find myself just more outside of the film than I am really invested in what's going on in the actual story, right? I mean, you're more watching this, you're much more curious and interested about the process of making it than you are in what you're actually seeing on the screen, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I don't the thrust of part of the story at the end is that the boy, Harold Blankenship, sees his mother and Robert Forster's characters having sex, and he runs away. And she basically looks at him, looks for him through the riots.
Right.
Which could be conceived as kind of a contrived thing just to get us to the riots. And I mean, there, I don't know. I mean, if you're looking at it realistically, I don't know if she would actually stay walking throughout these riots looking for her son. But
I mean, I bought that. I bought that just fine. But like you said, I mean, if you're going to show up with a camera and do it, why not just document it?
Right.
And interview some people about it. I mean, it's like,
well, that's the thing, is that, and this is kind of what my paper was about. So when I interviewed him, and is kind of using a fictional lens to tell a nonfiction story, and we spoke when I talked to him. I talked to him a couple times. We talked a lot about political film, and because at that time, I had made one. So I wanted to discuss with him, like, what kind of that was all about, but, that's what interested in him, he kind of used the storytelling lens of a fictional film to do what he wanted to do most, which was probably beat someone over the head with a message, that's the way he decided to do that. He made one other film in the early 80s, is not documentary style. It has a very similar premise to Medium Cool. But other than that, he was a prolific cinematographer. He shot Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Who shot Virginia Woolf?
Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? Virginia Woolf?
Who shot because I was thinking who framed Roger Rabbit? Who shot Liberty Valance? What's the title again?
The film that shot was the Eugene O'Neill play Who's Afraid of Virginia
Who's
Woolf.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I'm not, right, exactly. Not O'Neill, I'm sorry. That is an Edward Albee play.
And then he also shot Coming Home with John Voight. And I think he was fired off of Cuckoo's Nest. And
well, yeah, he was fired off of Cuckoo's Nest. That's a very interesting story of how he got fired off of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Which I'm surprised. I don't know if you talked about this when you interviewed him, but one of the ironies is this is
no,
about...
that didn't come up.
Okay, well, but this is interesting. So one of the, the sort of plot of this film is such that this reporter finds out that the network is using his footage to sort of cooperate with the FBI and spy on these protesters, right? And Wexler actually filmed in 1976, I believe. He was one of three filmmakers who actually interviewed people from the Weather Underground movement. It was a documentary called Underground, which he shot with two other filmmakers, and he basically just interviewed some of these weathermen in such a way that their names and faces were hidden. So that the FBI couldn't know who they were. And that film actually got subpoenaed by the FBI. So it's kind of weird how this movie was made 7 years before. Pretty much the exact same thing happened to him. He makes a movie interviewing these sort of like, you know, anarchists. And then the FBI says they want that footage. And that subpoena was actually repealed. There were a few famous people who rallied behind him to get that subpoena repealed. Jack Nicholson was one. I believe Elia Kazan was another. But Wexler actually claimed that the reason he was fired off of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is because that stuff was happening to him at the time. And
right.
Milos Forman contends it was just like, you know, an artistic difference or whatever.
He was very difficult to work with. And I'm actually reading the Woody Allen autobiography right now. And it turns out he actually was, I don't think you like this movie, but I'm a big fan of Hollywood Ending. He was originally hired to shoot Hollywood Ending. And
Hollywood Ending is nice. It's fine.
It's nice. Very condescending answer. It's
not a great movie, but it's fun. It's one of those like sillier slapstick comedies.
Yeah. It's got some good stuff. But he was supposed to. This is something I did not know until I read the book, that he was supposed to shoot that movie and he got fired off that movie. But there's also been other instances of that. That was a Michael Douglas production, Cuckoo's Nest, Michael Douglas was a pretty liberal guy. I don't know if he would have been the one to fire him off that movie. That would have been his job. That's entirely possible. I'll have to talk to Paul about that. There's also something also prophetic about Medium Cool, is that when they're making Medium Cool, no. It was around the time they're making Medium Cool, they wanted to shoot this other film. Haskell Wexler and somebody else who worked on that movie, and the Rolling Stones came to them and asked them if they wanted to film their concert series, and it ended up not working out because they were like, Haskell Wexler was like, yeah, that's gonna kind of compete with this other project that we're working on right now, and that movie ended up not getting made anyways. And so he was like, I can recommend you a couple guys. And so he recommended them the Maisel brothers, who were also very big documentary filmmakers. They made Grey Gardens. And so they got hired to direct this Rolling Stones concert film. And that was Gimme Shelter. And in Gimme Shelter, at Altamont there, that Hell's Angels kill a guy in the audience of the show. And it was, of course, filmed by those cameras. For that documentary, which is kind of ironic as well. Haskell Wexler also was the guy, and that's a lot of the idea of like the media kind of, there's just being kind of a disparity between the person filming and what's actually going on. How much do they actually care about what they're filming? Are they just only caring that they're filming it instead of what they're filming? Because Haskell Wexler, he filmed the footage of Jane Fonda that gave her the nickname Hanoi Jane on top of I think she was on top of a tank or something like that. That was filmed by Haskell Wexler. And there's another situation like that where he filmed, you know, somebody being killed, but he kept filming anyways. So I thought that that's kind of an interesting way to come at the story about the media's kind of relationship with these types of events.
Well, that's actually where the title of the movie comes from. Yeah. So the Marshall McLuhan line, you know, the famous phrase, the medium is the message. We did a whole show actually on the Do Dissidents podcast about him. We were lucky enough to interview somebody who had sort of like a touring, like speaking series on him. Obviously, he described film as a cool medium, as opposed to like the printed word as a hot medium. And you know, the thing about McLuhan is it's very high minded conceptual stuff. And I feel like this movie is kind of the same way. It is a little tough to see exactly why it was made the way it was made, as opposed to just doing a straight, like, guerrilla documentary about the DNC riots in Chicago. Like, I don't understand when I'm watching it. And I saw this movie a long time ago, in my early 20s, at the recommendation to one of our, I guess, friends who really liked Haskell Wexler. He was a DP himself, and he was obsessed with Haskell. He liked Haskell Wexler, and he liked Caleb Deschanel.
Deschanel.
And to this day, even though they're very different types of artists, I still kind of confuse their filmographies just because I learned about both of them through this guy. Like, I'm here thinking Haskell Wexler shot The Natural, which, of course, that was Caleb Deschanel who shot The Natural. But, yeah, so, I mean, I guess coming back to just my general take on the movie is that it's interesting from a sort of scholarly standpoint. And certainly from a sort of film history standpoint, is it an easy sit? No, it's really not. You know, it reminds you a lot of Lord of the Flies. When I was reading Lord of the Flies in high school, looking back on it, once I was like prompted to write an essay about it, I actually appreciated it much, much more than while I was reading it. Like, when you look back on a book like that, you kind of admire it for its ideas, much more than you actually enjoy the process of reading it. And I feel like Medium Cool is the exact same way. Like, looking back on it, you could see how clever it was. Even what you call a contrivance, right? Okay, we have to get this footage of a riot. We have to get convention footage, right? How are we going to do that? We can't stage, like, elaborate dialogue scenes because we'll never get them. So how can we just have an actor walk through a crowd and document what's going on? Well, she's trying to find her son. Right? It's a perfect way to make that happen. And so, you know, it is undeniably clever. I would even say there is a revolutionary aspect to it, just because it really is just like guerrilla filmmaking.
Once again, I mean, it is, when we're talking about that new kind of filmmaking that was coming in the late 1960s, early 1970s, I mean, at that time, you want to take a narrative story and then use these documentary elements. I mean, that was just a new way of doing fiction. I think you have to almost look at it in the context of that time. Because you had the it was separate. There was documentaries, and then there was fictional films.
Sure.
And that was really part of this whole new movement to make movies more realistic. That's when movies started. Because remember, there was a time, a little history lesson here, a little cinema history lesson here. You don't think about today when you watch a movie, but there are so many more movies today that are shot on location now than there once were.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because there was a time when everything was done in studio, most likely on a soundstage or a back lot that's meant to look like a real location. But as time went on in the 50s and then much more so in the 60s, they started getting out of the studios and more on location in real life places. And that's what this kind of embrace. So you have to really look at it in the context, I think, of the context of the time. And I kind of like like I said, it's a slice of life almost, because you have all the, just this, it sets up this world of this type of character, of these types of characters that they're trying to portray. And you have all these different examples of the media and their relationship with the subject that they are documenting. And then, of course, it ends with them being in the middle, of course, of this most volatile situation of all. Kind of all bubbles after you have all these different examples of all these different things, like race and poverty. It all kind of bubbles over, if that's the correct phrase, at the Democratic National Convention. And I don't know. I think it's kind of neat because, you know, if you didn't know anything about this movie, you might watch it and think, oh, well, they staged all that stuff. Those were all actors. The people, when she's walking through and there's, like, literally a guy has been kicked in the face and, like, his, like, fellow protester friends are, like, wiping the blood off his face. And, you know, they're thinking, oh, just walk in front of that guy. And that's I don't know, brilliant. Revolutionary at that time. I don't know. So I appreciate it for that. But, yeah, I would say you have to look at it in the context of the era that it was produced. Instead of, and like I said, because you know why? Anybody could have done a documentary about the 68 Democratic National Convention. Anybody could have done a documentary about
it. Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
But this is, you know, a little different. And so I appreciate it because of that.
Yeah, and then, so the movie kind of has this very strange bookend, where it starts out, where Robert Forster is, like I said, sort of dispassionately photographing the ruins of a car wreck off an exit ramp on the highway. And there's this woman who looks like she's dead, you know, sort of hanging outside the passenger seat of the car. He photographs it, he passes it off to a colleague, and, you know, goes on to the next job. And then at the end of this movie, just out of nowhere, he gets into a car accident and kills the woman, you know, the mother of this boy. And then it essentially just ends right there.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
Well, it,
there's actually, I didn't do a sufficient enough job of explaining it. Then somebody else comes, sort of takes some pictures, or do they film them? But they document
well,
it in some way.
Well, it's basically twice. It's, there's a circular kind of nature to the movie, where he in the end becomes like one of the subjects of his reporting, that he is kind of, you know, he's always been at a distance. At he videotapes him or takes photos of him at the beginning of the movie, at this wreck, and then calls the cops or calls an ambulance or whatever. And then at the end, yeah, which is weird. Also, that was a very interesting scene because they're driving and then they announce the crash before they actually show it.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting. That was very interestingly cut together.
And then the crash happens. And yeah, somebody comes by and takes a photo, and you know it's exact like you said, it's kind of exactly like the same thing that happened at the beginning. Only he's on the other side, and then it turns over to these stanchions that when you go to any type of these political rallies, the media. In fact, I think the audio in that scene is like it's talking about how NBC is perched across the way in terms of, because there's audio going on still of the riots of the Democratic National Convention.
Right, you're still hearing the audio of the chaos from the previous scene.
Yeah. And you see these stanchions, and these are the types of stanchions that the media stand on when they're videotaping or filming live events. And then, of course, the cameras film each other, and so that's Haskell Wexler with the camera. And the camera pans over, and Haskell Wexler then shoots his camera into yours, or our camera shoots our camera into him. So of course, it kind of like then of course turns it on the audience. I don't know. I found that very prophetic, and we talked about that scene a lot when I spoke to him. I bought it. I thought that was a nice circular touch to the film.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. It was interesting. It's just, it's such a non-narrative film that to give it a sort of ironic and sort of neatly packaged narrative bookend like that struck me as kind of a strange choice, because the movie is just so abstract in that way. And to leave the audience where we started, you know, to sort of go back to where you started, just seemed like an odd choice for such a, like an experimental, almost non-narrative film.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely not a, not a well-written film. It is kind of a crazy film where they were just trying to do whatever they wanted. And I think when Paramount viewed the film, the first reaction was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And but they released it anyways. Remember, this movie was released by a major studio. This was released by Paramount Pictures in 1969. But when the movie came out, the reviews were very, very good. But yeah, I mean, you think about it, you know, he becomes the victim and it's the same thing kind of happened to him that he was doing to other people. And now that boy is without a mother, and that's going to probably force that boy into an even more of a difficult life, more poverty. That actor who played Harold, he actually is a resident of Appalachian, West Virginia, and he still doesn't know how to read, and he hasn't worked in years. He has a son named Haskell, though. It's a great document of that era for a bunch of different reasons. Just not only a document of kind of that time when the media was changing, because you can only imagine what, if you're trying to tell the same story, what that would be like today with even more greater forms of media that we have today. And the media's role in events when we have all these different forms of media, but also just a document of just an extremely volatile time in history. And obviously just a great document dedicated to that time in cinema history, about what cinema was doing at that time and where we've come since then. And a lot of it's because they took those initial first steps with those films in the late 1960s, early 70s by making film more realistic. But yeah, so yeah, it, it's kind of a, I would say a mishmash, that film, but you know, it's good. I like it.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, the influence of those kinds of movies, I mean, is undeniable. I mean, you see people, you know, like filmmakers take those concepts to the extremes, like with the, like, you know, mockumentaries in the realm of like comedy, like the Christopher Guest movies, you know, and then in the realm of like horror, like the Blair Witch Project, Paranormal Activity, things like that. But like even stuff that's not really pushing the concept that far, like even a movie like The Hurt Locker, you know, just a very realistic war film that looks like it is shot by people who are in the middle of the action, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that whole, the whole sensation that audiences get from those kinds of films owe a lot to the cinema verite movement. And so this being one of the first movies to sort of bring that concept to the U.S., yeah, I mean, it definitely has a place. I think it's listed as in the Library of Congress or in the like film archives. You know, it's archived as, you know, a historically significant movie.
It's Library of Congress. Yeah,
yeah, Library of Congress. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it's definitely an important film. It's an important film.
Alrighty. Well, I guess that's what we got to say about it, right?
I think that's it.
All right, very good. So you can follow us on Facebook, like us on all of our social media platforms, and you can, of course, subscribe to this podcast as well as the main Dude Dissidents podcast, and find us at patreon.com/Dude Dissidents, where you can support the show for as little as a dime a day. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for your support. We'll see you next time.
This is what Haskell Wexler told me. Take it easy, but take it.
Take it easy, but take it. All right, very good. See you next time, everybody. Thank you.